Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter. Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to Untangled from All Sides and WOSU Public Media. I'm Amy Jurevich. At the foundation of every school building is a battle over taxes, spending, and fairness. Education is a fundamental right. The responsibility is clear. But who pays? That answer is not so clear. This is a new season of Untangled, and this is a show where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. We explain it in a way that we hope makes it easier to understand. This season, we are tackling the cost of learning.
According to the Ohio Constitution, whether you like it or not, public schools are a shared responsibility between the state of Ohio and our local governments.
That's Representative Bride Rose Sweeney, a Democrat from Cleveland. She co-sponsored the Fair School Funding Plan, a bipartisan bill that created a new system and a new formula to fund Ohio's schools. The plan was implemented, at least partially, and then it got too expensive. Educating Ohio school kids is expensive. It costs billions of dollars a year. And joining us now to talk about how much money we are talking is Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. He wrote a school funding explainer piece for Signal. Welcome, Andrew.
Happy to be here.
So now, I'm going to just say that numbers on the radio are difficult, but we're going to give it a try. You wrote a school funding explainer because understanding how our tax dollars are spent on education can be confusing. So how do you like to explain it to people? There's three sources. Can you talk about those three sources?
Yeah, when I wrote this story, it was when Mike DeWine, the governor of Ohio, introduced his school funding budget. Well, he introduced his budget, and a major portion of that is school funding. And I wanted to write something that allowed people to at least understand the parameters of the debate. Here are like the different levers that state officials can pull. Here's why the teachers are mad about what the governor's proposing and that kind of stuff. So I think that the big thing to think about in school education or in education funding policy is that how much is the state actually paying for education versus how much are local taxpayers paying? And then the federal government also plays a role as well. But it's kind of that fundamental dynamic is really what explains a lot of what we've seen in the debate over school funding over the last 25 years plus. So the budget that the governor proposed, and this is kind of the status quo in Ohio, local taxpayers are now paying something like, and this number really varies based on which data you use, so let's just kind of qualify it like that, but local taxpayers are paying around 50% of the cost of K through 12 education now, and there are various reasons for that, but the Ohio Supreme Court in the late 90s found that Ohio's school funding system was unconstitutional because it relied too much on local property taxpayers to fund it, and they found that was inequitable because some communities have more ability to pay and some less. So, and when that ruling came out, local taxpayers were paying something like 35%. So we see the state paying less as a percentage than they did back then when this whole thing became kind of a legal issue to begin with. So that's kind of the base parameters of what we're talking about, which is how much do taxpayers pay at the local level versus how much does the state pay? So I forget which original question was that got me on the big stem winder, but I think that's a really important thing to lay out.
Yeah. So there's three sources, the state, the federal government, and local taxes. And the local taxes are usually property taxes. Sometimes they're income taxes, but it's much more rare. It's usually property taxes, right?
Yeah. So, numbers. I don't have this one at my fingertips, but I'm going to wing it. I think it's like 5% of locals' funding comes from income taxes. So it's the vast majority is property tax wealth. And so that's really important to consider when listeners might be aware that there's this proposal floating around that people are signing petitions to try to get on the ballot a measure abolishing all property taxes. That would basically radically underfund schools.
Cut school funding in half, yeah.
And that's so, but property taxes and school funding are very, very closely intermingled because of that.
Yeah, so local taxpayers, mostly through property taxes, pay about 50% of the money that goes into K-12 public schools. The state is at about 37%, and then last year the federal government was at 13%. But we have to have the caveat in there that that'll probably change because, as we know, there's a lot of talk about the Department of Education at the federal level. Do you know any more about the federal funding piece, or is it kind of a wait and see still?
It's difficult to line these up because the state, the federal government, and tax collections all kind of happen on different calendars. So you have to almost look back a couple of years to get the truly accurate number. So it's always kind of like a moving target.
But to look back a couple of years at federal money, that's a completely different world. So.
Yeah, but I did look that in the current moving forward state operating budget, that federal funding for education is supposed to cut something like 25%. I don't want to like have dead air while I try to pull the number up like that, but it is being reduced. Some of that is kind of a reflection of how much it went up during the pandemic. There's a lot of emergency COVID relief money that flowed here, but some of it too would reflect an actual cut in federal spending on education.
So education ranks as the second largest expense for state government. It's behind Medicaid. So when conservative lawmakers are looking to cut the budget and decrease spending, they want to reduce taxes. I mean, it's what Republican lawmakers in a red state like this want to do. They want to reduce taxes. They want to cut spending. So they obviously have to look at schools if it's the second largest expense in the budget. How do lawmakers explain their thoughts on school money? Because I've heard a lot in the past few months where they keep saying they're giving more than they ever have given before, but the districts all say it's not enough.
Yeah, so this was one of the reasons, I guess one of the main debates over this issue during the state budget cycle that kind of played out a few months ago. So it is true that the state will be spending a little bit more on schools than it did the previous couple of years, and it's like a 1% increase. Calling it an increase versus a cut, the governor originally proposed a little bit of a cut, and it's almost inconsequential. It's basically a flat funding.
Yeah.
But what the problem was that schools have is that the way that our school funding system is built is the idea, and this is actually Bride Sweeney, who you played the clip of earlier in the segment, the bill that she passed that changed how schools are funded. The goal that they tried to achieve was to actually fund schools based on how much it costs for them to deliver education. Before, honestly, I don't have the ability to understand it. It was kind of before my time, but there was a formula before and it didn't work. So to the point that the state basically just kind of like, oh, let's add more money here. It was not really
they put Band-Aids on places.
Yeah. It wasn't a logical system. It was kind of ad hoc. And so they tried to make it more logical by saying, let's build the formula based on how much it actually costs. So the problem that schools saw with this current budget is that the formula or the input they used for the formula for how much it costs was based on 2022, how much it costs to hire a teacher to, you know, fill a classroom 3 years ago. And as everybody knows, things cost more today than they did 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there was debate about, well, what if we did actually make that number reflect current costs? I don't have that at my fingertips, but it was billions of dollars more. And that would have prevented Republican lawmakers from doing all the other things they wanted to do, like cut taxes and fund the Cleveland Browns to build a new stadium. And so they decided to work off of 2022. And that's going to be a question that if they keep the formula the way it is, that every governor kind of moving forward is going to kind of be beholden to, do we want to keep this formula and reflect potentially, indefinitely increasing costs? Or do we want to fix it in a point of time? And then that kind of gets back to the fundamental question of, is this formula doing what we want it to do? So there's been talk from lawmakers about maybe changing that. They've talked about being concerned about, they call it runaway costs. But that's kind of, that was one of the core issues that we're sort of seeing very quickly emerge with this new school funding formula that they rolled out just less than 6 years ago.
This is Untangled, the cost of learning from all sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about how much it costs to educate Ohio school kids. We're talking with Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. When I told people we were doing this series on the cost of learning, several people said to me that they don't understand why it's such an issue. Doesn't the state just use all that lottery money? So now, come to find out, it's actually not that much lottery money. What's up with the lottery money?
So that is true that the kind of purpose of the state lottery when they created it was that you can't just say, well, we think gambling is fun. Let's let people blow money on lottery tickets. They came up with a public policy purpose. And so the profits from the lottery system do pay for K through 12 education. And it's not an insignificant amount of money. I mean, we're talking, I think, approximately $2 billion is the profit. And by the way, when we say profit, it's actually money that people are losing buying lottery tickets. Just to kind of keep the framing there, I think, in a way that's important. But it is a lot of money, but it fluctuates year by year, 15% of how schools are funded. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of like a drop in the bucket when you consider that local property taxes are like $14 billion a year. And that's really what pays for schools. But yes, lottery is a portion. If the lottery were to go away, that'd be a big problem that they'd have to figure out how to plug. But to help keep it into context, that's about the number that it represents.
So in this past budget, the state spent about $8 billion on K-12 schools, but about $1 to $2 billion of that was from the lottery. Is that what we can say?
The lottery is actually in addition to that.
Oh, yeah. Really? Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's a little bit more coming from the state.
Yeah.
But it's still, whenever we talk about the property taxes, that's where everyone is feeling the imbalance. So it's what took this school funding issue to the Supreme Court numerous times. It's that imbalance that made it unconstitutional. So what the Supreme Court was saying was basically, the state is not paying its fair share. Is that, and lawmakers disagree. Am I summarizing that well?
That's basically it. And like I said before, it's kind of like an equity issue where it's, why should I, Andrew, you know, the education that I receive be determined on how rich the community is that I live in? Because maybe, and there's all kinds of different configurations of ways to imagine wealth. So the current school formula actually is 60% property wealth and 40% income, which, you know, there's lots of numbers when we talk about school funding. But the idea is that maybe I live in downtown Cleveland where Sherwin-Williams is headquartered. There's all kinds of really tall buildings that are worth a lot of money, but maybe my family doesn't make very much. Or maybe I live in a rural community where there's lots of valuable farms, but people don't make much money. Or maybe, you know, some kind of combination reconfiguration of that. And so, like I said, the fundamental issue is that the Supreme Court, there's language in the Ohio Constitution that says that the state must provide well-funded schools. And the question is, what can we do to make sure that kids have the same kinds of opportunities no matter where they are across the state?
Now, and the idea that the funding formula has changed. I was reading up on it, and I think we've had four funding formulas in the past 15 years because lawmakers just can't agree on how to spend the money fairly. But this most recent one was this landmark bipartisan bill where they actually got, in theory, Republicans and Democrats both to agree. So why didn't it make it the whole 6 years? It only made it four of the 6 years it was supposed to be implemented.
So it has basically it's more or less been implemented, but it goes back to that issue that I was talking about earlier about if we really base the funding on what schools say it costs to fund them, the numbers get really big, especially in this inflationary period that we've experienced. And then it becomes the other problem that we have is that when they phase the school funding formula in to begin with, one of the types of school districts that it penalizes are those that are losing kids. And so if you're tying the funding that a school district gets based on the number of kids who are attending, you might see enrollment drop off, but schools still have the same number of buildings, the same number of staff they have to employ. I mean, the problem they're trying to avoid is maybe there's a small class, and so does that mean they'll have to close a school when maybe there might be more kids 5 years from now? Mm. Or maybe it's even just a political problem. Maybe I'm a lawmaker in a school district where funding has dropped, and I don't want that to happen because that's something that my constituents won't like. So what the state did to try to address that is they created something called a guarantee, where school districts were basically literally guaranteed to have at least the same amount of money they had the previous year. Mm-hmm. And we saw the governor try to phase out the guarantee, which was what he was basically supposed to do. And that caused, suddenly school districts were losing money. Mm-hmm. And so what the legislators did in the actual school budget that we had was guarantee the money again. And so we're already straying from the formula by keeping the guarantees in when they're supposed to be gone. Mm-hmm. We're using old cost data instead of what it actually school districts say it costs now. And pretty soon it's like a Jenga tower where you're pulling the pieces out and suddenly the whole thing falls over. And we're going back to what we did before, which is basically pick a number that we want to spend in each school district. And it undermines the idea of there being a formula to begin with.
Hmm. As a part of this series, explaining school funding, we're asking the question, is there a better way? Now, I know you're a reporter, so you're not tasked with coming up with any solutions. But in your reporting, have you heard people ask this question? And is there any answer out there to, is there a better way?
I think I'd be getting paid a lot more money if I had a good answer to that question. Mm-hmm. Something that I do hear from school finance people is that, and we might see this happen in general as legislators move forward with trying to reduce property taxes in some way. So to say what I was going to say is that the 5% of local money coming from income taxes, 95% from property taxes, there are things that school districts could do to shift more money towards income taxes. Mm. And so that does then raise the problem of, does your community have more rich people in it? And is that fair for places with more poor people in them? But one thing that could happen would be, currently, if you pay an income tax to the city of Columbus, but you live in Upper Arlington, it's a commuter tax, basically. And there's ways that this is offset, so you're not truly paying double what you'd be paying otherwise. But basically, cities have the ability to tax commuters because they're spending a lot of time in the city. City services are required to do that. School districts don't tax commuters. And so that one thing that maybe there'd be interest would be to apply the school income taxes to people who commute into the city as well. Or maybe you'll see more school districts pursue income taxes if they feel that property taxes aren't quite as available to them. So I guess the one thing that you could think of would be, can you diversify the ways that school districts can get money so that they don't have to just tax people in one way? But that doesn't mean I certainly am not an education policy expert, yeah. So I don't know. That would probably pose other types of problems as well. But that's mm-hmm. something I've heard people in the debate that I follow in Columbus. It's all revolves around getting the right, balance of funding sources. But then, you'll hear Republicans say that we spend too much money. If we need to think about how we can reduce the number of local government units we have, including the 600 odd school districts that we have. So maybe some of the formula has to do with figuring out how to keep costs down. But people have been saying that for years, and we still see costs going up.
Consolidating the 611 school districts we have, perhaps.
Right.
Right. Well, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for your time. We've been talking with Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to do it.
And I also wanted to add that for today's show, I wanted to talk to one of the architects of the Fair School Funding Plan. It was a bipartisan effort, but I was hoping to talk to a Republican lawmaker who helped develop the plan to get their thoughts on the version that passed 4 years ago and where it is 4 years later. But Representative Jamie Callender, who was a co-sponsor of the bill, was not available for the show. And I contacted the communications offices for the Republicans of the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate, and they could not find a lawmaker that was able to join me to speak on this topic. Coming up, we are going to explain the Fair School Funding Plan in a little more detail, and we are going to discuss whether or not it has actually been funded in the way it was supposed to be. That is when Untangled from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Untangled from All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Untangled is a show where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, explain it in a way that's easier to understand. And this season, we're tackling the cost of learning. Lawmakers have been working for years to figure out how to fairly pay for Ohio's K-12 public schools. In 2021, a landmark piece of legislation was passed. It was bipartisan and called the Fair School Funding Plan. It was created to address past rulings by the Ohio Supreme Court that found the old school funding system unconstitutional.
The reason they said we were not upholding our end of the Constitution was because we placed too high of a burden on our local property taxpayers. For the past 30 years, that is what we've been trying to fix.
The Fair School Funding Plan was implemented, partially, and then it got too expensive. Republican leaders in the State House say the plan does not work when you run the numbers. Here's Ohio House Speaker Matt Huffman.
Is there, in fact, enough money on transportation? Are we paying our teachers enough? Are we doing the things that we're supposed to, that the plan is called for? The answer is no, because that was never part of any legislation that was passed.
To help us understand the Fair School Funding Plan and what it was supposed to do and what happened to it in the most recent budget cycle, we have Aaron Churchill, Ohio Research Director for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Welcome to Untangled and All Sides, Aaron.
Thanks for having me, Amy. Glad to be here.
So the Fordham Institute is a conservative leading think tank that works to improve K-12 schools. Aaron's work focuses on school accountability, educational choice, and school funding. And I wanted to start with that first piece of sound I played from Representative Sweeney. Did the Fair School Funding Plan fix that Supreme Court ruling? Did this most recent plan make school funding constitutional?
So the question about the constitutionality of Ohio's school funding system has been debated for more than 30 years, going back into the 70s. When the school funding system was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in the Duroff cases, that was focusing on the school system Ohio had in 1990. And we spent overall in Ohio about $10,000 to $11,000 per kid at that time, in inflation-adjusted figures to today's dollar amounts. Today, we spend a lot more than that. We spend about $16,000 per pupil in Ohio. So what's happened over the past 20, 30 years, is that Ohio has steadily increased its investment in public education from $10,000 a kid to $16,000 today. So I think, you know, whether Ohio's system is still constitutional, I don't personally think it's unconstitutional. It has been brought to court. But I do think what the Fair School Funding Plan was trying to accomplish was putting some of that debate possibly to rest. But more importantly, I think what Cut Patterson was trying to do was increase the amount of funding overall that goes to public education. So even more than what we spend today, we spend $30 billion on public schools. And what this formula was trying to do was increase that even more. So I think, you know, we can have a spirited debate about whether enough is enough or whether 16,000 is the appropriate amount or whether we need to go higher, whether we should go lower. But what the Fair School Funding Plan fundamentally was about was trying to increase funding for public education.
And that cut that I played earlier from House Speaker Matt Huffman, he basically is saying that the plan didn't take into account everything. So he was saying the Fair School Funding Plan maybe didn't fully take into account the cost of transportation or teacher pay or a whole lot of other things. Do you think that that's true? Or do you think it was just it was expensive and he was trying to cut the budget overall and he saw a lot of money going into this?
Yeah, I think the Fair School Funding Plan, a.k.a. Cut Patterson, the price tag on it when it was initially rolled out in 2021 was an additional $2 billion per year, or $2 billion to fully implement the Cut Patterson plan. So it's expensive from the start. And then as what we've seen as it's been implemented is there are these inputs updates that are supposed to happen or supposedly supposed to happen in the structure of the formula. And that sort of put the state in a position where they're not only having to cover the $2 billion price tag from the start, but also increase the amount of spending through the design of the formula and how it's supposed to be maintained. So you could kind of think of the Fair School Funding Plan as like buying an expensive foreign car, like a Mercedes or something. It's expensive on the front end, and then it's also expensive to maintain, over time. So it is one of those formulas, and you can design a form. Sort of one of the little secrets of school funding formulas, you can design a formula that spits out any amount of money. I could sit here at my desk and create a formula that would require the state to spend $50,000 a student, $100,000. I mean, you can do all those kind of things with the calculations. What they did was create a pretty ambitious and expensive formula from the start. It's been challenging to maintain a system that is continues to update. And what number of people think would view as functioning fairly. So the expense of the formula has always been a challenge with it from the start.
I found a piece that you wrote back in 2021 when this Cupp-Patterson Fair School Funding formula was announced. You wrote that it was the fourth new formula in 15 years, but you were optimistic this one might stick. So what do you think now?
Well, I mean, I think I also had some comments about how it would be difficult to implement as well because of the expense. But the Cupp-Patterson formula did have a lot of political support when it was implemented in 2021. As you mentioned at the top, it was bipartisan. It was supported by Republican leadership at that time, Democratic leadership at that time. And the state has fully phased it in through the $2 billion price tag at the very least. And it has increased state expenditures in public education. Over the past 4 to 6 years, we've seen education spending go up from the state. So I think politically there has been support for the formula. I think now that we're getting into year 5, 6 of it, there are, as you mentioned at the top, some questions about whether the costs of maintaining the formula are truly sustainable over the long term.
Yeah, a part of that instability with the numbers is that is inflation, which, Cupp-Patterson wouldn't have known about exactly in 2021, but it's here. So therefore, lawmakers used 2022 numbers. In a piece you wrote more recently, you called them inputs. So the teacher salaries, for example, the cost of transportation, all these inputs of how much it costs to basically educate a child and run a school. But instead of using 2026 numbers, the lawmakers used 2022 numbers. What do you think of the fact that they didn't take inflation into consideration with these inputs?
Well, that was the one way that the most recent General Assembly earlier this year tried to contain or tame some of the costs of maintaining the formula was by declining to, readjust those inputs, the teacher salary inputs, the cost of health insurance, the cost of building operations. They declined to update those inputs, and that's how they constrained some of the costs. If they would have updated those inputs, it would have cost the state, $1.5 billion additional on top of, the initial price tag of Cupp-Patterson. So that has been the challenge with the formula is having these maintenance costs that are built into the formula in your formula. And it
So
does
why
put the
so did
state.
they I'm sorry to interrupt you, but they didn't want to pay the additional 1.5 billion, or they said they couldn't.
Well, I think they declined to update the inputs and declined to, spend an additional $1.5 billion on public education. They did increase the amount, but not by as much as what would have happened had they updated the inputs. On the issue of inflation, it's important to understand that one, we're not in the same era of Biden era inflation right now. We're at about 2.5%. That's a little hotter than, what the Federal Reserve would like to see. But inflation is not as significant as it's challenged as it should have been as it was a few years ago. And the other thing on inflation is that Ohio over the long term has kept pace with inflation in terms of overall spending on public schools. In fact, if you adjust for inflation, as I mentioned at the top, inflation-adjusted spending overall has increased in Ohio. So there has been, over the long term, a real spending increases that are happening in classrooms.
This is Untangled, the Cost of Learning from All Sides, and we are working to explain how we pay for Ohio's schools over the course of this series. Right now, we're talking with Aaron Churchill, Ohio Research Director for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a conservative-leaning think tank that studies education. Aaron, as a part of this series, I'm asking, is there a better way? Is there a better way to fund public education in Ohio? So if you study this for a living, if you had a magic wand and could make something happen, what do you think it should look like?
That's a great question. I think the most important thing when you talk about school funding, I do think there should be spending increases, you know, every year that does cover inflation. I think the legislature does need to look at that and look at, you know, are we spending appropriate amounts on education to make sure we're covering the cost to educate every kid? I think the bigger question around school funding is, are the dollars actually driving improvement in our schools? And there, you know, there's a saying in the business world that, you know, culture eats strategy for lunch. Mm. And I would actually argue that school culture will eat school funding any day for lunch. I mean, school culture, our policies that drive excellence, that drive achievement, are so much more important than actually our school funding formula, how much money we're spending in schools. I think there will always be an appetite and an importance in understanding the investment in public education in Ohio. We've proven that for 30 years in Ohio, that we can spend more money on education. We've proven mm-hmm. that. What we haven't proven is that money is going to improve student outcomes. When you look at our long-term achievement on national assessments, they're basically flat. Over the past 20 years, we've had some ups, we've had some downs, especially with the pandemic. But we're not getting the results that we want to see with all the money that we're putting into Ohio schools. Mm.
A lot has been said about the way school districts spend their money. Too much overhead, too many administrators, too much money sitting in their rainy day funds. Is that the problem, in your opinion? Are Ohio school districts mismanaging taxpayer money?
I don't necessarily think they're mismanaging money on the whole. I mean, obviously, I think there are cases here and there that you can always point out. I think it's the overall culture that we have in education. Right now, we're satisfied with what we have. We're okay with, you know, 50 to 60% of students achieving state standards on state proficiency tests. We saw the data coming out earlier today that about 60% of students in most grades and subjects score proficiency. And there's not a sense of urgency about trying to get the other 40% of students to proficient. We need to make sure that we have policies that are holding schools accountable to making sure that every student is learning, making progress every year. Every student graduates with a diploma that means something, where they can get a job after high school, where they can go to college if that's their aspiration. We need to make sure that we have policies in place that are driving excellence in all of our schools. And I think that is the fundamental thing that we need to focus on in Ohio. I think school funding is important. It's a lever that can be used to drive performance, but it's not going to do it alone. We need to have reform policies as well.
Most of what people get upset about is that property taxes are so high and so much money is going to schools. The over-reliance on property taxes is what took this issue to the Ohio Supreme Court to begin with, and it was declared unconstitutional because of the over-reliance on property taxes. So, but that would assume that the state needs to pay more of their fair share. What would you say to that argument that it's we need to reduce the property taxes, therefore the state should be paying more? The percentages maybe should be flipped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, historically, Ohio, about 40% has come from the state and about 45% has come from the local taxpayers, and the rest is kicked in by, you know, the federal government and lunch money and those types of fees. So there has been over time, like generally speaking, a roughly 50-50 split between the state and locals.
I mean, I have it, you know, at 50% is property taxes and 37% is from the state.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't looked at the numbers exactly. You may mm-hmm. be right. But your overarching point is, okay, I mean, what happens if you create like a system where the state is, you know, providing the vast majority of dollars, or maybe even all the dollars, to local school districts? I think that would be, you know, is an interesting concept, but you also have to think about issues of local control. I mean, if you have the state footing the entire bill, I mean, what does that do in terms of, you know, local autonomy to raise money locally? We have had a system where Local communities can weigh in on how much they want to spend on their own schools, where they go to the ballot box and say, okay, we want to spend more money on education. We would like to have, the nice auditorium or the extra arts and music teachers that we think are valuable to our kids. And we have had a system where local property taxpayers have that ability to weigh in. And that does, create a system where some of the wealthier districts can generate more money for their own education, for their own community's kids' education. But the state does come in and try to equalize across all school districts to ensure that every kid has an adequate level of baseline funding. And that's where the formula comes in, and it does provide more money to low-income districts.
I want to say thank you to Aaron Churchill, Ohio Research Director with the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk with the lawyer who originally filed the lawsuit that led Ohio's school system to be declared unconstitutional. That is when Untangled from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Untangled from All Sides and WOSU. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is a series where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, try to explain it in a way that's easier to understand. And this season, we're tackling the cost of learning. And disagreements at the Ohio State House aside, educating all of Ohio's school kids costs billions of dollars a year. $13 billion in property taxes, $8 billion in money from the state, and $3 billion from the federal government. That's a lot of money. Some argue it's not enough, some argue it's too much, but most agree that it's not distributed fairly. And the imbalance between state money and local money was at the heart of a lawsuit filed in the 1990s that eventually led to the Ohio Supreme Court declaring the state's school funding system unconstitutional. The person who has been with that school funding case from the beginning is with us now. William Phyllis is a consultant for the Ohio Coalition of Equity and Adequacy for School Funding. Welcome to the show, William.
Well, thank you. Thank you for letting me have this opportunity.
So for more than 30 years, lawmakers have debated and developed formula after formula to try to make Ohio's school funding system constitutional. Have they succeeded in recent years?
Absolutely not.
As simple as that, no.
Absolutely not. They've made some progress. They would have come to a constitutional system had they fully implemented the Cupp-Patterson program from the very beginning when they adopted it. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there's a recent study of the cost of disadvantagement, which essentially it cost about 50% more for disadvantaged kids than normal children. So had they fully implemented the Cupp-Patterson formula and put forward the add-ons at the level And of course, a more recent study that was ordered by the legislature indicates, as I said, it costs 50% more to educate disadvantaged kids. So the issue here is really, does the state really want to meet its constitutional responsibility? Mm-hmm. We have to start with what the Constitution says. And the Constitution, Article 6, Section 2, says that the General Assembly shall secure a thorough, an efficient system of common schools throughout the state. Now, how the state accomplishes that, which formula they use, is a question. But the point is, there's been a lot of discussion about, we can't really keep up with inflation. We can't really, in fact, a lot of people are saying we can't afford a constitutional system. And I think that's what the legislators have been saying. And we've been, Ohio has been in this position before. In fact, under the depths of the Great Depression, we were there. The argument is about, you know, how much is the state responsible for funding education? What percentage? Well, back in 1935, when the first foundation formula was adopted, the state put in 50%. And then the state percentage has gone down over the years. But those percentages really are meaningless in terms of the Constitution requires a thorough and efficient system of common schools. You know, back in the back in 1923, under the Corns Supreme Court, Ohio Supreme Court decision, the state was funding about 30%, or probably probably less than a lot less than 30%. In that decision, the court said, if you have lack of teachers, a lack of supplies, a lack of resources, then you don't have a thorough and efficient system. Now, what Cal Patterson did was to try to determine, and I think they did a great job of that, trying to determine the actual cost of educating kids. Now, it's kind of ironic that back in 1990, then-Senator Kopp was the chair of a committee appointed by the legislature to study school funding. Now,
he's been with this for a long time. Yes.
And the bottom line of his report was there ought to be a relationship between the funding formula and the actual cost of educating kids. Now here, you know, all these years later, Senator Kopp was involved as a representative. He was involved in developing this Kopp-Patterson formula, along with representatives from the education community. Now, you know, really, formulas are complicated, but the principle, the concept, the responsibility, the constitutional responsibility of the state is very simple. A thorough and efficient system of common schools throughout the state. Now,
You have written that developing a formula is actually the easy part, but getting the legislature to keep after the formula, despite leadership changing hands, that's the hard part. So the new leader, are you saying the new leadership that came in looked at Kopp-Patterson and said, I have to increase it by $2 billion. I'm not going to do that.
Well, you know, that was the problem in 1990 when we the coalition, had made some attempts to cost out education. We had the same problem under another Supreme Court decision back in 1976 through 1979 when the Cincinnati v. Walter decision was handed down. In that case, the court was really political and decided that the legislature shouldn't be burdened with that level of responsibility. See, it's not that we don't know, really, the cost of education. It's that the politicians over the years have decided the constitutional responsibility is too great. It's a burden too big to bear. And that's the problem. And the Kopp-Patterson, I think, finally got it right. But they didn't want to pay for it.
So they didn't fully implement it.
And by the way, you know, back in 1976, during the time when that Cincinnati v. Walter case was before the court, 45% of the general revenue funds of the state went to K-12 education. Now, it's a lot less. That is 45% of the general revenue fund. Now, today it's a lot less than that. So people talk about, oh, the cost of education is skyrocketing. Hey, the cost of health care is skyrocketing. The cost of other things are skyrocketing. The bottom line here is the state wants to overburden the property taxpayers and underfund schools from state tax money. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, and that was what brought it to the Supreme Court case that you brought to begin with, was the Supreme Court ruled that there was that it was not balanced, too much reliance on property taxes, not enough of the state funding. And in the most recent budget that was passed, the property taxes was about 50% of what's being paid for schools, and the state was at 37%. So are you saying that, are we needing to get to like 50-50, or should the state be taking care of this and property taxes be much less involved?
Well, I don't know what the magic number is, but what I do know is a 50-50% split really won't do the job. We have to get the state funding, unless we want to continue to overburden property taxpayers, we need to get the state funding in the range of 60 to 70% of the total cost of education, rather than, you know, actually the property taxpayers have had the majority of the responsibility for funding education from the very beginning.
Right.
And you know, it wasn't until 1935 that we even had any formula for education. It was all the property taxpayer, except for some of the rural districts that were so poor that they had to have a kind of a supplement.
Yeah. This is Untangled from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how we pay for Ohio's K-12 schools with William Phyllis, a consultant for the Ohio Coalition for Equity and Adequacy of School Funding. There's a lot of debate in the State House over whether school districts are mismanaging taxpayer money. I heard a lot about districts having too much money in their rainy day funds, too many administrators, they're not spending money wisely. What do you say to the idea that taxes are being mismanaged?
I think they're being mismanaged at the state level. I think the legislature is mismanaging school funding. They spent in this particular budget, $1.5 billion on the Ed Choice Voucher Program. Now, had they spent that much over the two-year biennium on the Cobb-Patterson, add that to the Cobb-Patterson funding plan, we wouldn't have a constitutional issue with school funding. Now, you know, it's easy to say, well, they're mismanaging. Well, you know, charter schools, the percentage of management going to the charter school industry is a lot higher than the public school districts. So why aren't they picking on, you know, the charter schools for mismanaging? This is just a ploy. When you compare education management with private industry management, the percentage going to management is a lot less. And when you compare school district management to charter schools, public schools are a lot less. Now, why aren't some of these critics out there saying, hey, the charter school
have too many administrators? Yeah. Well, during this series, we're talking about school funding, and we're also asking the question, is there a better way? So what do you think? I mean, if you had a magic wand and could fix things, what would you like to see changed? Is there a better way to pay for Ohio schools?
In terms of the wealth of the state and the income of the state, there has to be a balance between some sort of balance between the state and local funding levels. Now, in terms of a formula, the better way is what we have on the table, and that's the Cobb-Patterson Fair School Funding Plan. That's the better way. The better way is not to just flow our resources to vouchers. And by the way, who gets vouchers today? The bottom line of that, the last batch of vouchers went to those people that are making 10 times as much as the average person. And in fact, the voucher system in Ohio today is merely a subsidization of those people who have traditionally sent their kids to the private schools. Now, how insane is that?
We only have about a minute left, but one last question I wanted to ask you is, you wrote a recent opinion piece for the Dayton Daily News that said that if school districts are not properly meeting educational requirements, the state is constitutionally responsible to address the problem with the district. Is that happening? Is the state holding failing schools accountable? Because what most of this debate when it comes to vouchers is that people don't want their kids in failing schools.
Well, yeah. Let's go back to the Constitution. The General Assembly shall secure a thorough and efficient system of common schools throughout the state. The next article in the Constitution talks about the school district responsibility. And it says the provision shall be made by law for the organization, administration, and administration of the public school system supported by public funds. Now, if the state has a problem with the way school districts spend the money, if the state has a problem with the level of education, then it comes back to the constitutional responsibility of the state of Ohio.
Thank you to William Phyllis, a consultant for the Ohio Coalition of Equity and Adequacy of Ohio School Funding. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Untangled, The Cost of Learning. Be sure to subscribe to the Untangled podcast feed so you don't miss an episode. Next time, we're going to discuss how other states and other countries pay for their schools. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides and Untangled, and I'm Amy Jurevich.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.